For this evening's Dhamma talk, I've had a request to give a talk on the topic of the Buddhist suttas, the Buddhist scriptures. So I will. And the reason why the topic was requested was because it's often said, and I think I agree completely, that it's often the case that in Buddhism we hear lots of things about what Buddhism is, Buddhism's this and Buddhism's that and so on, or even what the Buddha said, but there's to be honest, there's very little realistic knowledge within most of the Buddhist community about really what it is that the Buddha did say and didn't say a long time. A friend of mine told me he'd heard a saying that the Buddha said that you should never use a cannon to kill a fly. Which raises a number of historical questions as well as the obvious ethical ones. But within Buddhist communities, it's quite normal, actually, that within Buddhist communities that you find scriptures that were composed even 1,000 years after the Buddha's life are still said to be the actual words of the Buddha and taken in quite a literal sense by the communities. Even longer than 1,000 years, that's not an exaggeration. There's even texts that are, many of you would know, heard of the Zen story where the Buddha holds up a lotus and nobody recognizes it, and the Buddha, and only Mahakassapa is the one who recognizes it. So that's attested, I think, no earlier than 11th or 12th century, maybe 14th century in China, something like that. So, you know, we're talking 1,500 years after the Buddha that story is first attested. And yet, everybody knows, look, this is what the Buddha did, you know? Can't actually quite say it's a discourse of the Buddha, it's just holding up a flower. Maybe he was just pointing out that the flowers on the shrine were getting old and they were replacing or something like that.
Oh, you mean the silent discourse?
Yeah, he holds up the flower, yeah. So, so one of the things which has been very important for me in my own practice, when I started practicing in Thailand, I didn't know anything about Buddhism. I went along to do a retreat. I'd read one book about Buddhism before that, which was Ajahn Buddhadasa's book called A Handbook for Mankind. And then I went to do a retreat. During the retreat, they didn't teach us anything. They just told us to just keep noting when it hurt. And when it hurt more, they said, just keep noting that. That's about it. And which was terrific. Not complaining at all. But then after the retreat, I really wanted to learn something about what is Buddhism about? What is these things? And so they gave us some recommended books to read. One of them was the classic Walpole Rahula's What the Buddha Taught, and a few others. And then I kept asking, you know, where's the real stuff? Yeah. And eventually I made my way to the Majjhima Nikaya. And haven't looked back since then. So these have always been the rock bottom foundations of my own Buddhist practice. Is first of all the practice of meditation, and secondly the study of the Buddha's scriptures. The third thing, which came a bit later, was my learning of the forest tradition lifestyle, the Vinaya, and the life of the monastic, which I learnt when I was at Wat Nanachat in China. So these three things. So for this evening, I'd like to give a little bit of an overview, what the suttas are, where they come from, how they're to be viewed historically, and so on. During this talk, please feel free, if you have any questions, please feel free. Because I'm not sure how much knowledge people have of the topic, so I'll have to be making some guesses there. Anyway, Buddhist scriptures, first thing about Buddhist scriptures is they're very big. There's lots of them. And that's one reason why people don't get around to reading them, because there's too many. You know, it's not like the kind of the Bible or the Quran where you can have one reasonably sized book. Yeah. And so typically what you find in most Buddhist countries, in all Buddhist countries and traditions, is that most people actually only know a very small fraction of the scriptures, and there's a few suttas which are taught as the very popular ones. And in Theravada Buddhism, they tend to be the Dhammapada, the Mangala Sutta, Ratna Sutta, Metta Sutta, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and a few others, Mahasatipatthana Sutta. Within the Mahayana traditions, of course, then they have their own Mahayana suttas, which are, again, of the hundreds of Mahayana suttas, only typically a few are actually widely known within those traditions. So there's a massive scriptural corpus, and typically only a small amount of it is actually used, which I think is a great shame, because I've always found that the scriptures or the suttas have a tremendous depth and a profundity, and one of the characteristics of them is that they're not necessarily immediately striking. And I remember when I first started to read some of the suttas, I was a bit disappointed. I thought that it's a bit dry, or a bit repetitious, or a bit straight. In some ways, it's a bit kind of obvious or straightforward sometimes. Yeah? Sometimes the things which you don't think are important are expanded on in great detail, whereas those things which seem to be really important and interesting are just kind of passed over, and you don't have any explanation of them. But one of the things which, for me, only really emerges after looking at them for a long time and over a breadth and reading so many of the different suttas, is just this quality of reasonableness and wisdom and rightness that the Buddha brings to every situation and every context. And the suttas are a very alive literature. They capture something. They capture something as it's happening. They capture the actual birth of something, the actual generation of something. And this is a characteristic of in all the spiritual traditions, that you find that at the roots of the tradition there's something which is very alive. There's something which is actually being caught on that cusp of coming to life, and that's where the vitality of it is. You know, if you look in the Christian tradition, you find it in the Gospels. If you look in the Hindu tradition, you find it in the Rig Veda and in the some of the Upanishads. There's that moment when that somehow that truth is becoming manifest and becoming realized and becoming articulated almost for the first time. And then later on the tradition, yeah, then systematizes, goes over, explains, rationalizes, philosophizes, interprets, and all of these kinds of things. And it's a much more processed thing. Yeah? It's a second hand. It all becomes scriptures about scriptures rather than being words about life. Yeah? It's words about words, which is what I'm doing here, right? I'm talking about words. Yeah, in a sense, you have to do it. I'm not saying there's something wrong with that. But there's a difference between that vitality that comes from the actual wellsprings of the tradition. So the suttas always have that, for me, that indefinable quality of that authenticity that comes from the wellsprings of the tradition. One of the characteristics of that kind of authenticity is that it's not necessarily systematic. It's not necessarily kind of organized and presented in a way that we find convenient. Yeah? And so this is the job of the later interpreters, editors, and so on, is to shape and present in different forms according to the technologies, the cultures, the expectations of the time and place, and to sort of digest things and present them in a more palatable form. And the suttas are sometimes a bit raw, sometimes they're quite difficult or quite challenging. They, maybe they talk on a very difficult level, and so it takes a bit of grappling with to really sort of see the juice there, to see the worth of it. But again, for me, I have to say that for me, it's that process of grappling which I find actually to be, again, what makes it really worthwhile. Yeah, I don't like things to be too digested and refined. And, you know, I prefer brown rice to white rice, you know. I like a bit of fibre in there, yeah, a bit of roughage. Yeah? That's what makes it tasty for me. So how the suttas came about. The Buddha practiced, he realized awakening, then he thinks, maybe I should teach this, then he thinks, no way, it's too hard, I'm going to give up. So this is the Buddha's first realization, which is a humbling thought for any of those of us who presume to come in the Buddha's footprints and to try to teach the Dhamma. To remember, the Buddha thought it was such a hard job that he might as well give up. Then of course he changed his mind and decided to teach the Dhamma, and he went to Benares, found the group of five monks. He taught the first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, in which we find the teachings on the avoiding the two extremes, practicing the Eightfold Path, and developing the Four Noble Truths. Now, one of the characteristics of the teaching, you know, you'll already discern there, is the use of numbers. Yeah? And if you look in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, actually is entirely constructed according to a system of very tightly woven numerical system, avoiding the two extremes, yeah, the Eightfold Path that you practice. And then it has the Four Noble Truths. It divides each of the Four Noble Truths into the three applications or three rounds of each Noble Truth. So you get this kind of quite complex numerical interweaving of things, which of course is a very powerful mnemonic device. It helps you remember things. If you know that there are four noble truths, 1, 2, 3, I know that there's another one somewhere, yeah? It helps you remember. Yeah? And so that kind of systematic way of presenting things is a mnemonic device, and which is of course one of the keys to understanding the early Buddhist scriptures, is that it was all an oral literature. None of it was originally written down. Like the teachings of Jesus, or the teachings of Muhammad, or the teachings, for that matter, of Pythagoras or Socrates, or for that matter, most of the great forest masters in the 20th century in Thailand, the Buddha never wrote anything down. I don't know if there's a message there. I don't know if there's some particular significance to the fact that most of these... I think that probably that there is a significance to that. But I should probably avoid going there too far, especially as I'm a writer myself. So I don't wanna. But so it was all memorized. And there's no doubt that the Buddha would have used a great many of these kinds of mnemonic means for helping people to memorize the scriptures. And the most important of those mnemonic devices is repetition, which you find all the way through the scriptures, all the way from individual words, the repetition of words, repetition of synonyms of words, repetitions of phrases, within sentences, sentence structures, paragraphs, and then whole sorts of every detail, a level, structure of language, is massive repetition and redundancy all the way along, which of course is a as anybody who knows anything about IT would know, is a basic principle of information storage, yeah, is that you have to back everything up, right? So the Buddha made backups all the time, yeah? He is constantly making backups, yeah? And it's very important, yeah? It means that if somebody forgets a word in a discourse, it doesn't fundamentally, usually, it doesn't fundamentally alter the meaning of the discourse, yeah? You can even leave out a sentence, you can leave out a paragraph, you can even leave out a whole discourse. It doesn't really alter the meaning of the Buddha's message because those same teachings are found in many other discourses. So for us who want to read something discursively, we want to start at one book and have something explained all the way through to the end, then finding our way through these repetitions is a hassle. So we need to have some sympathy for what the Buddha was doing and to remember that this helps to preserve it. And also, of course, the other thing about repetition is that it helps to get messages through thick skulls. Yeah? You hear it once. Yeah, yeah, sure. And you hear it again and again and again and again. And eventually it gradually sinks through. Repetition isn't the only device the Buddha used for mnemonics. The other one I mentioned, of course, the great one is the using numerical teachings. Many other devices as well. For example, the use of similes and parables. One of the great structures within Buddhist. All the Buddhist literature is you find this ABA structure. This is Buddhist, if you know anything about musical structure, this is kind of the basic structures in all kinds of music. You start out with a theme, you then introduce a variation, and then you repeat the theme again. Yeah? And so this is what the Buddha did again and again. He perhaps would state a doctrinal proposition, and then he would give a simile to illustrate it, and then he would repeat the doctrinal proposition again. And so within that structure, then you've got a kind of a unit of a teaching which you can remember. And so by all the Buddha's teachings, all of the suttas, are records of encounters. Okay, records of encounters, and these encounters are of different sorts. And because it's a living tradition, it's not kind of stereotyped and fixed. Okay. And you find, in fact, that there are dozens and dozens and dozens of all kinds of encounters which are recorded in the suttas. Now, many of the suttas, especially the shorter and more stereotyped forms, the settings become completely stereotyped. It's just the Buddha was teaching at Savatthi, and then he addressed the monks, and he said, monks, blah, 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 and gave the teaching. And so these kinds of teachings are just become like a sort of formal setting, but they don't give you any real information. But on many occasions, and especially for the longer and more interesting discourses, the context is very meaningful and very important, and it records the encounters between the Buddha and all kinds of people, the Brahmins, the wanderers of different religious traditions, skeptics, people who are like very aggressive and coming up and criticizing and abusing the Buddha, the monks who would have doubts, or the nuns, or lay people, people who are very sophisticated and educated, children, people who are very confused and lost, all of these kinds of things, incredible variety. Of people, all different walks of life. You know, you have the teaching the leper, teaching one sutta when the Buddha's there's someone who's in the audience who's starving, and the Buddha says, you know, please give them something to eat before they listen to the teaching. They need to eat first before they can understand. And on and on, these different people and different kinds of encounters all the time. So it's a very, very vibrant sort of portrait of the diversity of life in that time. This is something I think which is very important to remember. You know, the Buddha was not sort of just teaching in some kind of aloof, specialized, esoteric setting to kind of religious specialists who spent all their time practicing high levels of meditation or something like that. This is not how it is at all. It's a very vibrant tradition. an incredible records in terms of being a record of interfaith dialogue. Yeah? Hundreds, literally hundreds of the discourses are dialogues between the Buddha and people of different kinds of faiths and religious traditions, of all kinds. Some of them, you know, very polite. Some of them quite, you know, quite a strong dispute going on. And the Buddha always handled himself with great dignity, and sometimes with a sly sense of humour that he would use. And especially would use this sly sense of humour when he was confronted with the Brahmins. The Brahmins tended to be a bit up themselves, and they kind of they're like, oh, you know, you should be paying respect to us. You know, we're older than you. You should be where you're senior. And you know, our Brahmanical tradition goes back so many generations, and you should be respecting that. And the Buddha said, yes, it does go back so many generations, but you know, but he used a simile like one blind man leading the blind. So he used that simile. So the Brahmins were sometimes not very happy with him. But then he would then use these kinds of things to deflate pride in specific contexts, not because he wanted to have a go, but because he knew someone wasn't ready to understand the truth because of their pride. So sometimes using that kind of approach is the quickest way to deflate someone's pride and get them into a position where they're ready to hear the Dhamma. So it's these kinds of things which really show the existence of a personality behind these teachings. And this was an argument which was made some years ago by the English professor Richard Gombrich, and he made the point that committees don't crack jokes. Yeah, and I think it's a very good point. Yeah. So if we're trying to look for the person behind these things, yeah, that's one of the real traits of an individual, is their sense of humour, what they find funny. So all of these individual teachings, giving in different times and places, to different people, addressing different circumstances, and they would be memorized and remembered in a way which I think we find very difficult to understand. Okay, like these days, you know, very normally, if you have someone who goes to see a Dhamma talk or something like that, you say, oh, was it a good Dhamma talk? They say, oh yeah, it was really good. They say, what was it about? So, they remember the joke, exactly, yeah. Which is why the jokes are good, but it's true, isn't it? Yeah. So we listen in a very different kind of way. Yeah? Whereas in those days, that was how education happened. You listened in order to memorize specifically. For example, in Indian traditional music, the way that's passed down is that the teacher will sit with the student. The teacher plays a phrase, the student will copy the phrase, and the teacher plays it, the student copies the teacher phrase, the student copies, until the student gets it perfectly, and then they go on, they do the next one, yeah, and that's how it's transmitted. And that, I mean, that's not to say that system means you don't have individual creativity. Of course you do, but the creativity happens once you've mastered the system. Yeah? You master all of those things, and then you learn how to, you know, your own way of expressing through that. So the oral tradition in Indian literature had been around already for millennia, literally for millennia before that. And it's perfectly well established fact and not at all disputed that the oral tradition is capable of preserving texts with as much fidelity as the written page. Okay, that's not disputed. And the prime example of that is the ancient Brahmanical text called the Rig Veda. And the Rig Veda is a collection of, I think, about 10,000 verses. So a very large collection. That's about 20 times as big as the Dhammapada. And it dates to, well, the nearest guesstimate is about 1500 BC. So 1,000 years before the Buddha, but it was collected and compiled over a considerable period of time, and is a record of the. It's mostly is hymns, and it's quite recognisable as hymns. There's some more philosophical and narrative and mythological fragments and so on, but for the most part, it's like hymns of praise. And so it'll be O great Savatri, the all-powerful one, you know, may she fill us with blessings and may her bounty overflow, and all of these kinds of things. It has a very fresh and very positive kind of feel to it. And Rig Veda doesn't have the world-weary cynicism of a lot of later literature. So this was the religious hymns of the ancient Aryan people in India, maybe 1,000 years before the Buddha. Now that is preserved in a language that was preserved in purely an oral form for at least 1,500 years, and the linguistic forms, the details of how each word is pronounced and spelt and so on, is linguistically not at all doubted that actually does date literally and exactly to that time of about 1,000 years before the Buddha. It's been preserved perfectly, not just the general sense of it, but the actual specific pronunciation of every phoneme in the Rig Veda has been preserved with unerring precision for well over 1,000 years in the oral tradition. So this is possible. We know that it's possible, and we know that there are well-developed techniques for making this happen. Yeah, and in the Vedic tradition, they would do all kinds of things to be able to do that. Yeah, they do all kinds of things. I've mentioned before that you do this system where you recite and then somebody else recites back and so on. But then they do all of these other things as well. So you'd have another system where you'd recite backwards, right? So you'd recite each line of the Rig Veda backwards. Yeah, getting each of the phonemes exactly correct, and so on, and so, and not just forwards and backwards, but many other different systems of breaking it up in different ways, in order to ensure that it's actually perfectly preserved. So, I'm just saying this just to kind of allay the doubts that modern people often have, and when they think that if it's in the oral tradition, that somehow that means that it wasn't preserved well. It may or may not have been preserved well, but that's not to do with whether it's the oral tradition. And what needs to be distinguished here is this oral tradition, if you like, if you can call perhaps an oral canonical tradition, okay, which is like the Vedas and the Buddhist tradition, where there's a scripture regarded as canonical, which is deliberately preserved within a specific tradition which is dedicated to preserving it. Okay, that's one kind of oral tradition. And then there's a much more common kind of oral tradition, which is an oral folk tradition, which is something quite different. An oral folk tradition, stories are preserved, and the storyteller will bring them out and tell them with variations and playing around with it, greater and lesser detail and all of those things. And so this is a much more playful, much more flexible approach to literature. And of course you find this within Buddhism as well, that when the scriptures would be taught, as I'm doing now, then it would be improvised and played with, but the basic canonical core would remain the same. And then during the oral performance, if you like, you can consider giving a Dhamma talk a performance. During the oral performance, that would be elaborated and changed, and examples would be given and so on, but the basic text would be preserved word for word. So by saying this, I'm not trying to say that everything in the Buddhist scriptures was literally preserved word for word. This is not the case. But it certainly is the case that there's a good reason to think that a very large proportion of it was preserved very accurately. Now, so during the Buddha's lifetime, you know, you can imagine the situation. You know, if you have this teacher who's teaching, students gather around, try to learn the teachings, they're planning to apply it and practice it and so on. Sometimes they would travel, somebody would say, did you hear a discourse from the Buddha? And then they would repeat something that they'd heard the Buddha said. Then somebody else would meet the Buddha at a later time, and then he'd repeat it teaching on a similar topic, but not quite the same as the one he gave earlier. Yeah, he's allowed to do that. He's the Buddha. Okay. And then that person who received that one might then go and meet up the first person who heard the first discourse. Yeah, and so it would be a very complex situation in terms of actually preserving what is the teachings of the Buddha. Right? So you can say. You can say on a simple level, somebody might say, what is the teachings of the Buddha? And someone might say, well, he taught the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and so on. But if you want to say specifically what did he teach, well, I'm sure everyone would have known certain basic discourses like the first discourse on the Four Noble Truths, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and certain other basic passages everybody would have known. But apart from those ones, different people would have known all kinds of different things. And there's nothing wrong with that, especially in that context where the Buddha himself is there, because he doesn't actually want everybody to know everything. He wants people to know what's relevant for you at this time. Yeah? And when you come to see the Buddha, he's going to teach one person one thing and another person another thing, because that's what they need for their spiritual practice. So notice this kind of shift between what I was saying before, that kind of that living tradition, yeah, where somebody comes and says, how should I practice? And the Buddha says, you should practice like this, yeah. And then the systematic tradition, which is collecting all of those pieces of advice to all of those hundreds of people and then arranging them and organizing them in a canonical collection. Yeah? So this is what gradually happened started to happen during the lifetime of the Buddha. And during the time of the Buddha within the suttas, it refers to a canonical collections which are known as the nine angas. Okay, anga simply meaning a section. I'm not going to go into what all the nine angas are here, but I'll simply say that from my research and according to my understanding, actually the earliest part is actually the first three angas, and I'll just explain briefly what those first three angas are. And those are called in Pali Sutta, Gaya, and Vyakarana. Now, Sutta, Gaya, Vyakarana. Sutta meaning literally thread, Gaya meaning literally song, Vyakara meaning literally answer, okay, or explanation. So, just explain what each of these three means in terms of the Buddhist scriptures. What is that? Sutta? When we're speaking, when I've been speaking all the time in this talk up to now, I use the word sutta to just mean any of the Buddhist discourses. Okay, it's called a sutta, and that's how it's always used in modern discourse. But actually, the word sutta means in the Indic tradition generally, it doesn't mean that. What the word sutta generally means is an aphorism or a brief saying. Okay, that's what a sutta is. And so a sutta was usually like just a couple of lines or a verse or just a short little snippet, which would then be used as the basis for commentary and explanation and so on. So the sutta is a little kernel which was preserved while the teaching was woven around it. So this is why that word sutta meaning thread. It's like the thing that ties everything together. So in this three angas, Sutta, Gaya, Vyakarana, that's what sutta means. Sutta means those basic short statements where the Buddha would sit down and say, monks, there are these four noble truths. What for? The truth of suffering, the truth of the origin of suffering, the truth of the ending of suffering, and the truth of the way of practice leading to the ending of suffering. These are those four noble truths. Full stop. That's a sutta. Okay? So these suttas are collected and arranged in terms of the main important topics of Buddhism: the Four Noble Truths, the Five Aggregates, the Six Senses, Dependent Origination, Eightfold Path, the Five Spiritual Faculties, Five Spiritual Powers, Four Satipatthanas, Four Right Efforts, Four Bases of Psychic Power, Seven Factors of Awakening, and Dependent Origination. And these are the main topics in which the suttas were collected. Second of the three angas is called Gaya. Gaya literally meaning song, but in this case referring to verses, and especially to mixed verse and prose, and especially to a collection called the Saggata Vagga, which is one of the collections in the Samyutta Nikaya, which I'll come back to later. And the third of the three angas is called Vyakarana, which literally means answer. And what Vyakarana refers to is literature which is in a question and answer format. Okay? And what the Vyakarana is, essentially, is questions and answers about the sutta. Okay, so the Buddha says, this is these four noble truths, suffering, the origin, the ending, and the path. Somebody comes up to the Buddha and says, but what do you really mean when you say suffering? And the Buddha says, well, there are these kinds of suffering. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, and so on. So he gives an explanation. And one of the remarkable features of the Buddha scriptures is that almost every scripture of any length is actually in a question and answer format. There are very, very few discourses where the Buddha actually sat down and just talked at length. There are one or two like that, but almost all that are of any length at all are in a discourse, question and answer format. So this is Vyakarana, is the explanations. Yeah? Now, the earliest Buddhist collection was organized in this kind of format. Then the Buddha died. Sangha got together and said, well, we want to try to preserve these teachings. This is something that's very marvelous and very precious, something which we believe is of inestimable value to the world and should be preserved for the benefit of future generations. So they said, how can we do this? And so there was a great organization, bringing together of energy and vitality to maintain this. Yeah? And then remember, this is an incredible thing to do in those days, yeah? How many people have their sayings and their words preserved from 500 BC? Yeah? Very, very few, only a tiny handful. And how many people have that much of their teaching remembered and preserved? I don't think anybody, actually. I don't think anybody has as much as the Buddha. That's because of the energy and the effort that went into it. Now, when they got together, they organized it. They rearranged the system of the angas, and they rearranged it into another system, which we call these days the Nikayas, most commonly, although actually, historically, the better term is the term the agamas. And these agamas originally were four, which is the long collection, long discourses, which is about 30-something long ones, obviously. The middle-length discourses, roughly 150 medium-length discourses. The Samyutta Nikaya is discourses collected according to topic, and the Anguttara is discourses collected according to numerical sequence, yeah? Numbers of ones and twos and threes and fours and so on. So the basic text that we have today in Buddhism, what we call the suttas, is mainly these four Nikayas. In addition, there's a fifth Nikaya called the Kuddhika Nikaya, or Minor Nikaya, and the Kuddhika contains actually many of the most popular Buddhist teachings. The Dhammapada and other things are all in the Kuddhika, and they're mostly verses, mostly poetry. The Kuddhika, again, is kind of a miscellany. It contains some very early things, but also quite a lot of later additions as well. So when we talk about early Buddhism, when we talk about the suttas, when we talk about what the Buddha really taught, essentially this is what we're talking about, okay? In addition to this, the Buddha taught the monastic codes, the monastic Vinaya, which is a slightly separate topic. But apart from the suttas and the Vinaya, there's really nothing which exists today which was historically taught by the Buddha. Okay? So everything else, all of the Mahayana suttas, all of the Abhidhamma, all of the commentaries and legends and traditions and things like that are all the product of the later tradition. That's not to say that everything in these four Nikayas was taught by the Buddha. There is a degree of later development and accretion and so on within the four Nikayas as well. But what we find when we study these things is that when we study them, we use various text critical methods to try to discern which parts are likely to be early, which parts are likely to be late, and so on. And one of the most basic of those text critical methods is to compare the different recensions, the different versions of these texts. Now, so far I've been talking about these texts as if there's just one thing, okay? And the most common and most well-known collection is the Pali collection, which is found in the Theravada tradition. But in addition to that, there's also a set of four Nikayas found in the Chinese tradition, many similar Nikaya texts also in the Tibetan tradition, and also many found in Sanskrit and other texts as well. So what text scholars do is they collect all this material, they compare it, and you correlate each sutta to each one. You say this sutta is the same as this one, this sutta is the same as this one, and so on, and compare them. And if you want to have a look at some of the basics of that, if you look at a site called suttacentral.net, it's a site I did with some friends a few years ago, and that has a very comprehensive correspondences between the scriptures in the Pali and Chinese and other collections. And there's thousands of them, right? Thousands in Pali, thousands in Chinese, and many hundreds in Tibetan and other languages. So when we do that, when we compare them across this thing, what we find is that in almost every case, we find that the actual teachings, which is attributed to the Buddha himself, are virtually the same in every version. Okay? So the Buddha taught this is the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the origin, the ending, and the path. And that is taught exactly the same way, no matter whether it's from the Chinese or Tibetan or Sanskrit or Pali or whatever. It's identical. Of course, there are always little bits and pieces that are different here and there, but basically it's taught the same way. But what will change is some of the more extraneous things. Perhaps the structure of it might be slightly shifted, or the setting might be slightly different, or the people who appear, the characters who appear in one particular discourse might be different from one to the other. So these kinds of things will change. But the actual content of it, the actual meaningful part of the teaching, stays the same, no matter where it appears, no matter what recension it comes in. So this is one of the jobs which textual scholars have done. And for me, this is a very kind of powerful affirmation of the faith with which the Buddhist traditions have passed down these teachings and the care which they've taken to preserve them accurately. Remember kind of what the kind of the attitude would be, you know, it's quite important, you know, if you're presenting these things, you know, you'd feel kind of mortified if you get it wrong, right? It's really bad karma, right? If I say this is something the Buddha taught and he didn't teach it, or something like that, then, you know, it can be really bad karma. But on the other hand, you wouldn't want to leave anything out or distort anything that was there. But on the other hand, it's quite open to add things, right? You might think, oh, well, you know, to add or to elaborate this is just by making it clearer. I'm not changing anything. I'm just making it clearer. Yeah? So things were added, but they weren't so much taken out or changed so much. I mean, it happened from time to time, but not to any great extent. So the the Buddhist traditions, of course, usually assert that the scriptures all stem from the time of the Buddha without any change. When in the modern period, of course, with the introduction of the text critical scholarship, these assumptions came up for question and were debated and so on among the scholars, both East and West, and sometimes, just as a kind of ideological point, it's sometimes said that the text critical scholarship is a Western imposition, but actually it's worth noting that by far the greatest amount of textual scholarship in Buddhism done in the last century, outweighing all the rest of the world put together, has been done by the Japanese. And that's happened since the 19th century. Although most of it is.
We don't know about that.
Because it's all in Japanese.
Right, okay.
You can get Sarah to translate it for you if you like. Yeah, there was a book put out about 10, 20 years ago now by a Japanese scholar called Nakamura, who actually tried to address that, and he put out a book which included references and summaries to all of, you know, many of the works that have been done in Japanese. But you know, again, that's, if it's not actually translated,
I mean, it must be a real treasure trove waiting translation.
Absolutely. And many things which, you know, we're probably still not really aware of, because it was the Japanese who did all the fundamental work, in, for example, correlating the Pali and Chinese suttas, all done by the Japanese scholars. You know, later details were corrected by some of the Taiwanese and Western scholars, but basically it was all done by the Japanese. Yeah. And you know, and they've had like kind of official sponsorship and so on. It's been done through major projects in the big universities and things like that. Yeah. That's sort of culturally quite interesting, because that was part of a kind of a sense of an Asian renaissance, which Japan, especially the early 20th century, was kind of seen as the figurehead for a sort of distinctly Asian cultural center, of which Buddhism was a very important part. So they were collaborating, as it happens, with the German scholar Max Müller, which is where they learnt a lot of the text critical methodology. So these books, the suttas, have been these days have been translated into English. The Pali ones have, anyway, and available excellent translations by Bhikkhu Bodhi, which you can buy, and you should, and most of them available online and so on as well. But there still is a terrible amount which needs to be done. Of all the Agamas, the early Buddhist scriptures in Chinese translation, hardly anything's been translated into English. Not one major collection of Chinese early scriptures has ever been translated into English. This is a crime against humanity. I mean that, seriously. I mean, can you imagine? There's treasure trove of ancient scriptural teachings, which is just never been translated. Similarly with the text from Tibetan, not one single substantial early scripture has been translated from Tibetan into English. And we're talking like over the last 150 years of Buddhist studies. Right? So this is, I think, a terrible thing and a terrible failing of the academic world, the Buddhist academic world, to have not done this, but also the Buddhist world, that the Buddhists themselves have not shown enough interest in our ancient scriptures to actually do the work and put the resources in to actually make this happen. The things that I've been talking about now should be common or garden knowledge to every Buddhist. And we should all know these things, but in fact hardly anybody really knows it. One of the basic reasons being that an actual historical awareness of Buddhist scriptures is very threatening to traditional Buddhist ideologies, and this of course is the case with all religious scriptures, yeah? And text criticism. We think of text criticism as something maybe a bit dry and a bit, a bit academic and so on, but it's actually one of the most dangerous ideas which has ever been invented by humanity, is the idea that sacred scriptures can be subject to human reason, yeah, and can be investigated in a historical basis. It's an extremely threatening idea to many people, which I think is the fundamental reason why a lot of these things are not better known than they should be. So this is just a bit of a few reflections and a bit of discussion of the suttas, the early Buddhist scriptures. So I encourage you to get hold of them, buy some copies of the middle-length discourses, the long discourses, connected discourses, and Bhikkhu Bodhi's long and eagerly awaited translation of the numerical discourses on Gutta Nikaya, which I hear, after 10 years or something of waiting, is going to be out soon.
This Heart Sutra and Diamond Sutra,
yeah.
Where do they originate from?
Okay, so these are Mahayana Sutras. Mahayana Sutras began to be composed perhaps roughly 500 years after the Buddha. The Heart Sutra and Diamond Sutra are part of that class of Mahayana Sutras called the Prajnaparamita. Diamond Sutra...
But from India?
From India, yeah. Mm. Yeah, composed... Yeah. But they're mostly known about through China. So most... Yeah.
Associated with China?
That's right. They were taken from India to China and translated. And what we actually have is the dates of the translation. The Chinese were very methodical with these things. They recorded this was translated by so-and-so in the place of such-and-such at such-and-such a date. And because the Chinese history is quite well known, you can actually put an actual specific date on those things. But that's, of course, only the translation date, not the actual scripture. Yeah.
When you say they originated 500 years after, you mean that the ideas were handed down, or that they were handed down, but they were actually written down?
No. They were composed. The Mahayana Sutras were composed afresh. They're new compositions invented 500 years after the Buddha, 500 to 1,000 years after the Buddha.
Imagination.
Okay. Yeah, this is quite. You need to understand the difference between the Pali Suttas and what I've been calling the Suttas up to now, were the teachings of the Buddha, remembered and passed down through the tradition, with some editorial elaborations and adjustments and so on, and written down about 400 years later. Okay, Mahayana Suttas were composed from about that time, 400 or 500 years. So they're new compositions. They're not they weren't at that time a traditional scripture. Yeah. And probably the coincidence of dates is not a coincidence. Mahayana literature appears at about the time that writing started to be used. And recent tendency in Western scholarship has been to say that those things are linked, and I think that's very true. And this also undermines this idea that oral tradition is less reliable than written tradition. To pass down an oral tradition, you need to get a whole big bunch of people, get them together, organize them, and teach. You need schools and all of these things. To make a written literature, you need a piece of paper and a pen. Yeah? Which is not as trivial as we think about, okay? To actually make the manuscripts and the writing materials was actually quite expensive and difficult. It wasn't as simple as what we think it was. But still, anybody can sit down there and write a sutra. Huh? Write it. Yeah? And so what we find appearing at that time for the first time, if you look at the Mahayana Sutras, they're so imaginative and creative. I mean, it's just this incredible outpouring of creative energy, which is just unprecedented. I mean, it's just a phenomenal creative outpouring. And I think a lot of that is due to the liberative possibilities of actually being able to write your thoughts down. So a lot of them would come from things like the visions that people would have in meditation and so on. And for the first time, you could just record those.
So they were not claimed to be the words of the Buddha.
They are claimed to be the words of the Buddha. Yeah, yeah. So all this Mahayana literature and all the later literature is always claimed to be the word of the literature. That is a false claim. But to what degree it was actually, people actually thought that the claim was going to be taken literally in the sense that we take it, is another matter altogether. See, there's one of the things about the later literature and the Mahayana literature. If you look at the Pali suttas, okay, they're very stereotyped in terms of the literary forms. Yeah. Thus have I heard. At one time the Buddha was saying in Savatthi and so on. If you want a fake one, it's the easiest thing in the world, right? Yeah, it's completely easy to fake a Pali sutta. If I wanted to introduce a new teaching, right, and actually pass it off as an original sutta, it's the easiest thing in the world, right? You just do that, you change a couple of phrases, right? But the Mahayana suttas don't even try You know, they're just so over the top. You know, there's no serious attempt to actually situate it in a realistic historical situation. I don't think my personal view is that the authors of that literature would never have imagined for a moment that anybody would be so silly as to think that this was a literal historical discourse in the same sense that the early discourses were. I don't think that they thought that for one moment. And I don't think their audiences thought that. Their audiences were already familiar with the early Buddhist scriptures, and they knew, obviously, this is a completely different kind of thing. I mean, it's like the difference between watching a news account of somebody stumbling around filming a riot with an iPhone, right? This is the early suttas. It's got the realism. It's like someone watching a riot with a video on an iPhone compared with Avatar, you know? And as if somebody can watch Avatar and think, yes, this is the same kind of thing as, you know, it's so different. So I don't think that anybody could have seriously meant that at the time. But of course, in later generations, you lose that perspective. And then you come to take it as being a literal historical event. Yeah.
In what other ways did the Mahayana differ? You know, when you say it was so imaginative, how did it become to differ? Was it more allegorical? Was it more, you know, did it shift to another realm in any way? How else was it different?
Oh, all of those things.
All of those.
Yeah.
It became
allegorical. We find and Mahayana itself is so varied. It's not certainly in terms of Mahayana suttas, it's not like a coherent doctrine or school or anything like that. It's almost like every new discourse is an entirely new kind of thing. Some of them we find like long journeys, pilgrimages and finding different adventures and teachings and so on in different situations. Others are totally cosmic. Yeah, they're like UFO adventures. Others are like satires, like the Vimalakirti Nirdesha is like full of puns and humor and stuff. You know, it's even got a classic Buddhist knock knock joke. You know, they come up to the door of the Bodhisattva, they knock on the door, who's there? And the answer from inside, nobody.
Yeah.
How can there be no one there? I heard your answer. Yeah, well, of course, in the ultimate sense, there's no one here. Right? Yeah.
Who's there, you know, Jack, you know,
that's
the
right.
Hands at the door.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the tech is very, you know, has changed tremendously from the early.
I mean, you can always trace similarities, right?
Yes.
You can always say, well, every point in the Mahayana, you can trace it back and say, well, it has actually its precursor in this particular place in the suttas. Yeah, so it hasn't lost its bearings. I mean, it's a complicated matter, but the other thing to remember with the Mahayana is that it for at least 500 years in India, Mahayana was practiced, was never an independent school. I mean, it was some texts and teachings and so on which appeared and were influential among the communities of those who were already practicing early Buddhism. It wasn't like a separate thing. Yeah. So it wasn't as. It has to be seen within that context, not as something that's quite separate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So just
sorry.
I'm sorry, go ahead. No, I just wanted to ask, you know, in the preliterate society, the monastic training must have been quite different. There must have been a lot of emphasis on memorizing and chanting.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wonder in the historical records if there is anything about the daily routine, monastics, how much time they actually spend.
Oh, definitely, yeah, yeah. There's perhaps not as much of that as one would like, but yes, there are references to that, and that would be part of the routine, definitely. And it was generally the idea, it seems to be that the idea was once the Nikaya system had been developed, that what would tend to happen was what happened with the system, especially the four Nikayas, was that the teachings were broken up so that you have, on one hand, it's differentiated formally, right? But also it was quite cleverly organized so that each of the four Nikayas actually contains all of the major teachings. Again, it's this redundancy thing. So you can study just one Nikaya and pretty much get all of the major teachings in there, right? So what it seems that the system was, there was that normally a student would specialize in one Nikaya, and every student would, say, go to a monastery where a teacher was an expert in that, and they would learn a certain central text which were the basic ones within that Nikaya, and there'd be a list. So you'd have a list of, well, there's six discourses here, these are the first ones, everyone goes away, everyone learns that. And once you've got that down, if you want to then proceed, you can then learn the different sections. So say the Digha Nikaya, you have the three main sections. So then you'd learn maybe one of those three sections. If you finish that, you can learn two. If you finish that, you learn three. That's good. So students would do that according to their ability. Some students, of course, if they're very talented, would learn all of the Nikayas or even the whole of the Pratipika. Yeah. Yes.
I just wanted to ask about the Nikayas. Are they the kind of particular length? What distinguishes each Nikaya from the other?
So the four Nikayas, the first one is the Digha Nikaya. So that's distinguished by the length of the discourses. Okay, so the longer discourses are in the Digha, which in the Pali is 34 longer discourses. The Chinese version is slightly more. Or slightly different anyway. It's more or less now. Anyway, Majjhima Nikaya, middle length discourses, also distinguished by the length of the discourses. And in Pali, 152. In the Dhammaguptaka one has 222, something like that. Sounds like a lot different, but actually it's mostly just reorganized ones from other places. Sanyutta Nikaya is organized according to topic. So Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Dependent Origination, each one has its own Sanyutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya. And then Gurdwara Nikaya is organized according to numerical sequence. So there are these three kinds of training that you should do, and then there are a list of three and so on. So that's numbers of 1 up to 11 in the Anguttara Nikaya. Yeah. So it's purely formal. So those distinctions are purely literary and formal. And so but within each one, all the major teachings would be found. Yeah. But it's actually quite a subtle organization. Not only is there the formal distinction, but each one has a slightly different orientation as well. The Digha Nikaya is mainly orientated towards interfaith, and especially the interactions with the Brahmins. The Majjhima Nikaya is a more in-house general discourses for the monastic community. The Sanyutta Nikaya is more doctrinal specialists, and the Anguttara Nikaya is more for general lay teaching. So but that's only a very subtle shift in emphasis between each one. Actually, there's more overlap than there is difference in terms of the context. Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
No, the Tripitaka is then the three composed of the Nikayas,
isn't it? Or? Tripitaka is, one of them is the Suttas, uh-huh. Which is the Nikayas, and then the other one is the Vinaya, and the third one is the Abhidhamma. Yeah. So the Abhidhamma is the systematic. The Abhidhamma basically takes the content of the Suttas and then arranges it in a more systematic form, mm-hmm. Which is essentially what the Abhidhamma is.
Because all very conversational at the time, you know, all very much a time place thing.
Right.
How much different do you think we can imagine it would be if the Buddha was around now or 500 years ago, in a different place?
Your guess is as good as mine. Your guess is as good as mine. I mean, I tend to think that the basic teachings would stay the same. The way that they're expressed would no doubt differ. How that would differ, I have no idea. The Buddha, one thing that is clear in the...
Maybe a different way of putting it is, how much should we account for that, rather than trying to imagine what it would be like in these now. Yeah. Quite ridiculous, really. But how much do we account for the completely specific?
I don't know if that's an answerable question. But I think all I could say for myself is that I think that if you really want to understand the suttas, then we should try our best to also understand something of the cultural context in which the Buddha was teaching. So to try to put ourselves in those shoes, which means reading and studying the pre-Buddhist literature, the Brahmanical literature, especially the Upanishads, and having some idea of the history, culture and context that the Buddha was teaching in. I mean, there's a lot of that context in the suttas themselves, but I think to try to, you know, you can never do it 100%, but the more you can immerse yourself in that culture, then the more you can sort of appreciate how the Buddha was responding to that, and the more you can tell the difference between those kinds of things which emerge purely as a result of a response to a specific cultural context, and those kinds of things which have a more universal significance. It's not relevant. Well, it depends on time of place. See, again, I'm not sure that kind of way of thinking about it is that useful. I mean, for example, quite a lot of the suttas talk about the caste system. Now, we might think in Australia, talking about caste system is a bit irrelevant. We don't even know what the caste system is. But if you're in India, it's extremely relevant 2,500 years later. So, personally, I don't think that, you know, it's a matter of leaving out something or not, but maybe a matter of you know, focusing on or finding those things that are actually directly relevant. But this is one thing that the Buddha... If anyone does want to leave, we are going a little bit later than normal today, so please don't feel uncomfortable about drifting off. The Buddha did distinguish between those suttas which he called Nayata and Nitata. Nayata meaning having definitive meaning. And those suttas which are Nayata, which means having a meaning which needs to be drawn out. Yeah? So, and it's very clear that in the suttas that there is these differences. There are certain places where the Buddha was very clear, very definitive, very analytical. He defined his terms, and he obviously was trying as hard as he could to make everything specific and clear and concrete. And there are plenty of other places where he wasn't like that at all. And there's some places where the Buddha would sit down and say something completely enigmatic and confusing, and then just get up from his seat and go away. And then all the monks would be going, like, what the, you know, what was that about? Oh, I don't know, do you understand that? No, I haven't got a clue. And then they'd go off and they'd try to find somebody who can answer the question. Yeah? And so the Buddha clearly didn't want to give all the answers on a plate. He wanted people to ask questions. He wanted them to inquire. He wanted them to be confused and to realize, hang on, we've got to find the answer. Yeah?
But still, put it clearly, for 500 years, people are just repeating because of the strict oral tradition and the more folk tradition, but which more or less.
No. That doesn't mean that people were just repeating. It means that, because, you know, they're quite capable of distinguishing. Yeah. So what it means is that there was a lot of effort put into that process of just purely preserving it accurately. But then, in actual performance, that would have also been done in a variety of different ways, which would have depended on time and place and the individual teacher and so on. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's something you can see every Buddhist culture. You can see that happening. You know, if you go to Sri Lanka or you go to Taiwan or Burma or whatever, you'll always see that same thing. That there'll be a text or a basic teaching which is presented, and it's elaborated in all kinds of creative and imaginative ways by the teacher.
But still, you're saying there was a breakthrough.
Uh-huh, yep.
That something new, more creativity came,
yep.
And you attributed to the writing. But to me, it just doesn't, you know.
In the Mahayana.
That Mahayana.
Uh-huh.
Output.
Uh-huh.
I just link it to what happened in the new religious movement.
Uh-huh.
Now,
uh-huh.
At first, the master is quoted, and people are see what the master said that. But eventually the master is dead or whatever, and people have more courage to interpret and to write their own understanding. And so it needs some time before people feel somewhat, not exactly equal, but ready to engage, kind of more being in partnership. But before, maybe the personality is just so charismatic.
That's right,
the difference is so enormous, people just think, but we're going to just preserve.
Oh, absolutely,
Because we can't contribute to it. So it's a time needs to elapse.
That's right, yeah. No, I agree, yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So perhaps the Mahayana can be seen as people, or at least some people, saying, well, I too have experienced something which has got some kind of depth, which
absolutely
to be recorded in some way.
Yeah.
I was actually fascinated by what you said a little while back about the Mahayana and the Pali tradition kind of growing up in parallel, and perhaps a lot of the time even within the same institutions or the same community. And I mean, I find that a very attractive tradition. Do you want to elaborate a bit about that? Because I mean, we tend to sort of see Mahayana and Theravada as being sort of very separate.
I've always
felt that, that separation has something a bit funny about it.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, well, that separation is an outcome of the historical situation where, you know, Chinese and Tibetan Buddhism is quite separate from Theravada Buddhism. But in India, that wasn't the case at all. One of the things to peculiarities about the history of Mahayana, we really are getting a bit late here, so this is the last question. One of the peculiarities about it is that even though the Mahayana Sutras appeared fairly early, say 500 years after the Buddha, so around say 100 AD, and we've got the translation dates in Chinese, we know that that's a fact that they were there. But there's one inscription in India referring possibly to Mahayana. In that whole 1,000 year period from the Buddha up until about 500 AD, so there's about 500 years when we know that the Mahayana scriptures were there, they were present, they were composed, they were in circulation, but there's not a single scrap of actual material evidence for Mahayana in the whole of India for 500 years. Not an inscription, not a statue, nothing. So only one inscription, and apart from that, nothing. So the explanation for that kind of quite strange series of situations seems to be that, together with a lot of other evidence, seems that basically the monasteries would all belong to one or other of the traditional 18 early schools of Buddhism, which are all varieties of what we call today Theravada. Yes, Theravada type schools, a little bit different, but not that different. And within many of those schools, some of the monks or nuns within those schools would study and practice those things that are called Mahayana. And they probably were a slightly esoteric and perhaps slightly out there wing within the school, which had to in one way be distinct, but on the other hand, not alienate their hosts too much. Yeah, they had to sort of had to survive, and it's not until
at the same time it was a sort of a broad church, as it were.
That's right. And it's not till quite some time, and even today. I mean, even in the Tibetan and Chinese traditions, the monastic sanghas still clearly identify themselves as the sanghas of the early Buddhist schools. I mean, that's absolutely straightforward. They don't think of themselves as Mahayana monks and nuns. The Chinese East Asian tradition think of themselves as Dharmaguptaka. Tibetans think of themselves as Mudassarvasivada, in terms of their monastic tradition. So that's, you know, the monastic and the Vinaya tradition is, of course, that's the that's the ground, that's the matter. Right? Vinaya is concerned with matter. It's not concerned with spirit. It's concerned with eating and sleeping and walls and stuff. And so all the stuffiness of spiritual life is in the Vinaya, whereas the philosophy is something that can develop on top of that, but that's not dependent on it, not determined by it. I mean.
So
thank you all for your patience. So we should finish up by paying respect.
Araham Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivade Mathato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhamma Namasana Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangha.